Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're talking truth and reconciliation. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Martin Marmite McMahon, they're calling you, I believe, because you love him or hate him, folks.
It's more love than hate, Tony.
You only like the love. That blocks the hate. Much more importantly, and actually sincerely mean this, we are delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack by, I'm going to say, musician, activist and campaigner, but he's much more than that. He's a survivor. Stephen Travers is with us, folks, and Stephen is the survivor of the Miami Shoban massacre from the 31st of July 1975, and Stephen has kindly decided to give us some of his time because he has a Netflix documentary coming out in the next little while, and that's going to maybe open up to a whole new audience, a whole new world, the events of some of the traumas that have happened on the island of Ireland, and open some eyes here as well, because we have a tendency here, if we've spoken about to other people that we've had on the podcast, to not really own our history either. And I suppose when I started with, we're talking truth and reconciliation, that's where I want to start with you, Stephen, because we will ask that the stupid questions, Martin. We often say we ask the dumb questions. Can you give us a sense of why reconciliation matters?
Well, of course, reconciliation is very, very important, because if people don't get on together, well, obviously society doesn't work. I'm part of an organization called, I'm co-founder with Eugene Reavy, of an organization called Truth and Reconciliation Platform. And we deliberately put the word truth in there because reconciliation has to be built on truth. You know, if you think somebody, your neighbor next door, killed your dog, you're not going to get on with them unless you find out the truth, you know. So it has to be built on truth. There's one of the popular misconceptions about reconciliation is that it can be something that you impose on society, or you tell them it's necessary, and so therefore it must happen. Mm. But reconciliation is not about having two polar opposite factions meet in the middle of some purposely built peace bridge and hug each other. Mm. That's not what reconciliation is about. Reconciliation is actually it's the establishment of mutual respect and trust. And you can't have that without truth. So I don't think I like to use the word reconciliation without using the word truth. Mm. That for us is important.
And I think that's actually, again, we've been fortunate to speak to Trevor Burney and Barry McCaffrey about their documentary on the Lochan Island massacre and how the pursuit of truth there was, you know, again, the first step was truth, the reconciliation and the events of that. And, you know, even now, years and years later, that they're coming up against a system that has actually been, let's tell the truth here, it's been chilling on the effects of journalists doing their job, in effect, getting to the truth. You do a lot of campaigning for you've mentioned with your partner, Eugene Reavy. He also was I'm going to use the word trauma, but he also was in a huge trauma in only about 9 months after your events, where his three of his brothers were killed in his home, in the family home. Yes. Just do you mind? I know this is a difficult question, but you know, can you put yourself back in that time for our listeners and give them an idea of, you know, who you were then, and what it actually did, how it changed your life and turned it upside down?
Well, life in Ireland was different then. There weren't as many distractions, so music there was music and sport. Effectively, that was it. Mm. And Ireland had a confidence at that time I don't think it has now. Ireland was confident enough to grow its own stars, to grow its own rock and roll stars. From the 60s, from the very early 60s, this showband phenomenon happened. And because people like, you know, the current big stars at the time, contemporary stars, would have been Elvis Presley and Buddy Holly and all those. And Elvis Presley never toured really outside America. So Ireland had the confidence to have its own Elvis Presley. So you would have had people like Brendan Byrne. Now, it wouldn't mean a whole lot to a young audience. But if you can imagine, say, some of the bands today, or just as talented as they were back in the 60s, 70s, but as I say, because there was less to take your attention with. So you would have had a band like the Royal Show Band, which was the one that Brendan Byrne fronted, and they could arrive in a Comer van, something about the size of a transit, a Ford Transit van. And that would be all of their equipment and eight lads, and they would arrive in the middle of the countryside where somebody had erected a big marquee a tent and put 3,000 people into it.
And it was a live music scene. It was a huge live music scene. My dad would have been a show band fanatic, and he'd had the Iron Ballroom in Parnell Square. This is where there were the nightclubs of the time. But it was all live music venues. So there was a lot of travel involved, a huge amount of travel involved for the lads who worked in show bands.
Yes, it was a big industry. I remember, there before, when Enda Kenny was the Taoiseach, they were talking, having a chat about employment in the country. I remember saying, would you like to put 10,000 people into employment almost overnight? And he says, yeah, absolutely. I said, well, go down to RTE and tell them to do what France does, give a 40 or 50%, to insist that it's 40 or 50% of the music played on the station Irish produced or by Irish artists. And all of a sudden you would start a healthy industry again, because the music industry isn't healthy. But going back to what I was and where we were at the time, we were living in a very, very healthy music industry. We could go down to the TV club, which is, I don't know what it's called now, but it would have been in Dublin, just at Harcourt Street.
Yeah.
And on a regular Monday night, nothing special, just an ordinary Monday night, not even a bank holiday or anything like that. Well, when I joined the Miami Show Band, we would put 2,500 people in there on an ordinary Monday night. And that's pretty much unheard of today.
It's huge figures.
Yeah. And we would have done that sort of around the country. We were playing. We always liked to have one night off a week. It wasn't always possible. You know, I think we did. I remember doing 27 nights on the trot.
But you were the baby of the band, though.
Well, Tony Gertie used to pretend he was, because when I joined, Tony said to me, how old are you? I said, I'm 24. And he said, I'm 23. But I found out afterwards
he
was actually 24. Tony was, an absolutely fabulous guitar player. Came from Stanaway Road in Crumlin. And just to put it into perspective, Tony was... Rory Gallagher was a big, big fan of Tony Gertie's, and Rory would always come to see Tony whenever he was playing. And he actually gave Tony his AC30 amplifier, Vox AC30 amplifier, out of respect for him. Gary Moore would have always come to see him. But because Tony wanted to get married to Linda, who's actually a sister of a great guitar player, one of Tony's students, a lad today, probably one of Ireland's greatest guitar players, Jerry Hendrick. Jerry was a student of Tony's, and so Tony sort of basically tidied himself up, came out of the rock bands. He was in one of the most outrageous rock bands, Adolf J. Rag, and they were, a phenomenal band, but they were mad.
You wouldn't get away with that.
You wouldn't get away with that, not politically incorrect. But the band was very, very talented. And I was the last one to join. Fran O'Toole wanted to be, he was But Fran was a pin-up, you know, all the girls loved Fran. I had the unfortunate job of having to stand beside him on stage.
Like me and Martin.
Yeah. I have to stand beside Tony.
But they made me really welcome, and
But you were grafters. It was graft. It was hard work.
Yeah, it was. Well, I never found it hard. They didn't either. It was the easiest thing I ever did in my life, you know. Just to play music. I couldn't believe somebody would actually pay me for it, you know.
When you find something you love, isn't that what they say? It's
a bit like you riding a motorcycle.
Yeah, you know? I love riding. Yeah. Like motorcycles for me are that thing, you know. They just are.
Actually, Anne and I had just got married in 1974, and they got in touch and they asked me if I would if I'd like to join, and I went and met them, and as it turned out, the bass player or the guitar player at the time wanted to go back on bass. He was another Dublin lad. He was I was living down the country. I'm from South Tipperary, but so then they told me, well, look, sorry about that, the bass player's job isn't going, but would you like to join on lead guitar? And of course I said no. You know, I turned down the Miami in September of 1974. They came back to me in 1975 and at the end of May. And I always remember being disgusted at the idea that I had to do an audition. You know, I felt this was a bit of a slight. But what happened was that when I went up, I found there was the word had leaked, so there was about 10 of really fabulous bass players had gone for the job as well. And when I heard them playing, I thought, you know, these fellas, they could play anything. Yeah, so I was going to just leave and go away. I thought, you know, I don't have a hope, because one of the features about my playing, I've never played the same song the same way twice in my life. You right. know, I wasn't
a jazz musician in there. Isn't
yeah. I was one of these people that sort of, I improvise all the time, you know, and I wouldn't have known the exact patterns of the songs. So what was happening, there was these fabulous players and every one of them went up and played perfectly, yes. you know, and so I was the last one. And the one of the directors of the band came down to me and said, well, do you want to give it a go? And I said, well, okay, I'll give it a go. And I was thinking to myself, what was happening? Every time a bass player went up to audition, Fran was sitting at the keyboard, and he was a fabulous keyboard player, and he had a list of songs, and he would show it to the prospective bass player, and he'd say, you know, what do you know from this list? And of course these guys knew everything, you know, they would say. And so I thought, if he asks me this question, you know, what do you know, I had been playing rock music. I hadn't been playing any of the pops that they were doing. So I hadn't a clue. And I thought, I can't blag this one, you know, I just can't bluff it. So I just wondered, what will I do? So I walked up and I had a very unusual bass guitar. It was a plexiglass see-through guitar. There's only
so
three.
So rock and roll.
Well, there was three in the country as far as I know. Brush Shields had one, and Phil Linnett had one, and I had another one. And I've
there's some names to be dropping.
Oh, it's tough.
And they showed me this list, and I said, I looked at the list and I thought, I don't know any of these songs, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, well, can we just loosen up and jam for a few minutes, you know?
Yeah.
And he was amused, you know, that nobody had ever done that before. And he said, yeah, sure, what do you want to do? So I made up a riff, this soul riff, you know, so I just started, and the band joined in, and we're into jamming for about 2 or 3 minutes, and he stopped the band, and the directors of the band were sitting at a table examining everybody. And Fran just turned around to the director and said, this is the guy I want.
Well, there you go.
And I was very relieved, because if he had asked me to play the pops, it would have sent me. I think the other good thing that happened as well is that I was such a bad singer that they felt relieved there wasn't going to be any competition.
Somebody's already got to get the girls, you know, the lead singer.
So it was a very, very happy band. I mean, we were, you know, we hit the ground running straight off, and the management brought me down to Mooney's in Parnell Mooney. I don't know if that's still to talk about the wages, you know, which is very important. And at the time they said, well, it's £50 for three nights and £10 a night after that. So, you know, if you were doing the six nights, you ended up with 80 quid or something, whatever it was like that.
that was a fair decent wage.
It was okay at the time, yeah. But because they made me do an audition, I thought, well, you know, I said, no, I have to have £15 a night out. I want £55. So they agreed.
And this is so you had some swagger at 24. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
24 going on 14, I had no responsibility. And my wife she's like stunningly beautiful girl, Anne, and we were like living the rock and roll life. She had the, you know, the long flowing cheesecloth dress skirts, hippies, and the headbands, and she was like the Pied Piper. Everybody loved her, and you know, it was just one of those, you know, the beautiful people. It was fabulous doing the things, and it's the easiest thing in the world they ever did. You know,
and how long you were on the road then? For how long were you on the road for?
Well, we were. Every night was an adventure, because, you know, I had played everything from, I started off as a blues player. I unlike a lot of other musicians who would have gone sort of into country or pop or whatever, I started off, I was very, very into everybody from Lead Belly to Robert Johnson and all of those great players. I loved B.B. King, and we were hugely influenced by John Mayall and all that, you know. Peter Green, John, all of the great players. And then the whole pop thing became very interesting, because the 60s was a renaissance for music. It was just fabulous. And I was very big into the Animals, and obviously the Beatles and Stones and Kinks and all of these bands. And it was a very interesting time, and you learned and you developed. And so were the other lads in the band. But when we went on stage with the Miami, it was pure pop. But I remember on the night that we were heading off to off to Banbridge, which was the last night that fateful night. Yeah, you know, people are often maybe surprised too that we played. There was one album, you know, there were cassettes you used to put into the car, but the album we played all the way up was beautiful. Sunny summer's night. Was Roadworks by Edgar Winter, which would be, an outrageously heavy band, you know.
Yes.
Johnny Winter's brother, Edgar Winter and Johnny Winter. And so that was the type of music. But the minute we went on stage, we were everything from the Beach Boys to the, you know, all of that type of thing.
And all of you were in the back of a van.
No, we didn't travel with the gear. We had our own personnel van.
That's right. Yeah,
a Volkswagen minibus, as all good hippies do.
So you had your own personal vehicle for traveling in.
Yeah, we had. There was two vans. There was the roadie would have had all of the equipment. Except our guitars.
And it's true to say, though, I don't know if I'm going to make an assertion based on my limited research, that it was thought of that on that night on the way to Banbridge, when you were stopped by men posing as
we're stopped on the way back.
Sorry, on the way back, and they were the idea that I'm aware of is that they were trying to make it look like you were actually the people carrying a bomb. They were going to plant.
Well, it was more subtle than that, because at the time the background to it was that the British security forces, which would have included the UDR, the Ulster Defence Regiment, at that time the biggest regiment in the British Army. Some of them would have been part-time, some of them would have been full-time, but a lot of them part-time. And they were pretty much dreaded by the local, especially the Catholic community, because they were heavy-handed. And But at the background to it is that security forces, I'm talking about MI5, MI6, and British Army, were very, very unhappy with the security arrangements south of the border, because they felt that if the IRA committed some outrage in the north, that once they got over the border, they were pretty much home and dry, you know, especially, say, coming down towards Dundalk or wherever that. And the reason for that, I mean, they were quite right when they to be concerned about that, insofar as there wasn't stop and search. The minute you crossed the border from south into the north, you were liable to be stopped by, you know, at any stage, on any part of the road. But the minute you came down, it wasn't the case. And the reason for that was that the local TDs in the border counties were reluctant to have stop and search, because their constituents would have been crossing the border from, you know, 2-3 times a day, whether it was for cigarettes or cheaper petrol or
work,
groceries or work, whatever. They would have looked at it as almost like harassment, you know. And so that was the reason that the British security forces decided, actually a brilliant plan, they decided, well, how do we put pressure on the southern government to seal the border? And they came up with this great plan. They decided, well, let's frame the most trusted and even loved commuters. You know, let's frame them as terrorists. We'll, if we can do that, then the international community will insist. You know, if we can say so that there are people, you know, that need to be searched, we to justify the stop and search, we will force the Irish government then to institute this stop and search, stringent stop and search. And unfortunately, they picked the Miami. We had dropped the name Showband. We weren't called the Miami Showband. We were simply called the Miami because it was a pop group. We didn't wear suits. We were very much a pop group.
On trend. They were very much on trend at the time.
Well, in our band was, you know the way the international bands didn't wear suits. It was, whereas the old show bands would have worn suits.
That's right. Yeah, you were more up to date.
Yeah, we were. But they wouldn't let go of the name Miami because it had been an institution since 1962. Yes. So, you know, they were trying to get the best of both worlds. Mm. But so they decided that they'd frame us as terrorists. So on the way back, we were stopped at a roadblock on, it must have been about 2:30, I think. Well, about 2:30. I think we finished the dance at 1:00 or 1:30 or something. And I remember the last song we played was a hit that the band had the year before called Clap Your Hands, Stomp Your Feet, which was one of those things, an audience participation number, you know, where you get the crowd clapping along and stomping the feet. It was a bit of an anthem. And we were just flagged down, and which was unusual. Beautiful, beautiful morning. Brian McCoy, her trumpet bear, was driving the personnel van. And as I say, we didn't carry the gear in that van. But we did carry our guitars, Tony's guitar and mine, and Des's sax, because we wouldn't give the roadies our guitars. Roadies are rough characters.
Yes.
Throw the stuff around the place.
They're like Martin on his motorbike. But
yeah, well, I wouldn't put my guitar on your motorbike.
I wouldn't advise.
And other than that, and I had a small little case as well. I used to use, funny enough, at that time, I read recently where Bootsy Collins, that played bass with James Brown, and he had Parliament, that band, that funky band Parliament, that he was claiming that he was using effects pedals, like wah-wah pedals and stuff like that, in 1976. Well, I have news for Bootsy. I was using it in 75 and 74. So there you go. Ireland, we were way ahead of the curve there. But I love Bootsy Collins, in case anybody's... other than that, that's what we had. And it was a bit of an adventure. I was still living the you know, getting used to it 6 weeks into the band.
Now, you crossed the border a lot. That wasn't something unusual to cross the border.
Twice, three times a week.
Yeah, it was something you did all the time.
Yeah.
Very comfortable doing it. Had you been subject to stops before that?
Oh, yeah, stops. But we, you know, if it's the UDR, the vast majority of those were Irish, Northern Ireland. And they would have recognised the band instantly. You know, Brian opened the window and they say, oh, lads, how are you doing? Have you got any records or CDs?
You're just as popular in both communities. Oh, yeah, there was
no... Sure, well, the band itself was Catholic and Protestant from North and
absolutely.
South.
And on that night, it was just... It was very different. It was these men who entered the... What they wanted to do, as you said, was frame you as terrorists.
Yeah.
The idea... But the plan went horribly wrong.
Well, the plan was that while they were talking to us, they actually asked us to step out of the van. Now, that was unusual. Martin, you were saying there where we stopped. We'd never be asked to stand out. Well, at least in my experience, we hadn't been. We were asked to step out, and Brian was almost apologetic. Brian was our trumpet player. He was from the north. He was a Protestant lad. And he said, we've got to stand out. They want to do a check on the van. And so we stood out and we sort of lined up and facing the ditch. And there was a drop of about 3 meters down into the field in front of us. And they were questioning us. We actually had to put our hands on our heads. You see, it's like see it in the movies. And that's what it was to me. You know, when we stepped out of the van, I could see maybe five or six soldiers. I wouldn't have known one uniform from another, but they had submachine guns and with perforated barrels. I was quite fascinated by that. But everybody was relaxed about it, and they were actually joking with us. And there was a bit of banter between them. Some of them were crouched down, others, when there was one man with a notebook and there was another man who appeared to be in charge, and asked us our names and addresses. And then this man, now whether he had been there when we got there, or whether he arrived, there was a car pulled up behind us, whether he got out of that, I'm not sure, but he was most definitely an Englishman, a very posh English accent. And he had fatigues on as well, but they were slightly lighter colour, and his beret was a lighter colour. I think it was almost like a fawn at the time. It was sort of a light brown. And he took charge, and he had a very posh English accent, which I would have recognised, because my first job after I left school, I went to London, and I was a trainee broker at Lloyd's in the city. Bit like yourself.
Yeah.
And so I would have been, you know, I got to know all the various different types of English accents. This man was definitely, you know, one of the...
Upper crust.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember quite taken by him. He looked cool. There's no other way to put it. You know, this fella had his sidearm, and he had... And I thought to myself, yeah, if ever I was to be a soldier, I'd like to be this fella. You know, he was...
Yeah.
Everybody sort of, all the banter stopped, the joking stopped, and he was definitely the man.
He had a presence.
He had a presence,
swagger.
Yeah. And very businesslike, very businesslike. And he changed the order from, he asked, what is the man with the notebook doing? And the man who appeared to be in charge at the time said, he's getting their names and addresses. And this man said, no, I want their names and dates of birth, which I believe is the proper procedure. I don't know. But there was, I heard people opening those on the back of a Volkswagen. The engine is in the back, but there's a little shelf over the engine. You can lift it up like a flap, and there's a that's where we kept Tony's guitar. He had a lovely Gibson, a cherry red Gibson 335, and I had my plexiglass bass. It's called a Dan Armstrong. I'd like to get another one, but I heard the click. So although I had my hands on my head, I sort of looked around and I saw somebody, and I thought, well, they're going to open my guitar case, and I might damage it. And because I was the least experienced of this. I actually took my hands down and turned around and walked a couple of steps. I mean, I was only about 3 or 4 steps away from the back of the van. And I said, can I help you with that? And but there was a naive thing when you've got
five or six people pointed at you. Yes.
And he said, he pointed at the little case, the little, almost real little brown case, and he said, what's in that? And I went to put my hand out, and he hit my hand and knocked my hand down. I thought, you know, it's a bit rough. It's not something you expect these lads to be at.
Mm.
And I said, there's just effects pedals. And he said, are there any valuables in it? In hindsight, it sounds as if maybe they thought the money from the gig was in it, you know.
Yes, maybe.
But we didn't. We never touched, we never saw any of the money. We were, as I say, we were on wages, you know. So that would have gone off with the road manager who was gone ahead of us. And again, unusual because he had gone, but we had been delayed at the gig. The ladies had given us a meal afterwards. And so I said no. And so this guy just turned me around, hit me very hard into the back and knocked me back into line. But instead of, there was only 5 of us there. Ray had gone home. So there was Tony Geraghty, Fran O'Toole, Brian McCoy, Desley and myself. And I had been in the middle. And when he knocked me back into line, I was now
on the edge.
Now second from the van. So Desley was on my right and Brian was on my left. And Brian nudged me, my elbow with his, and he said, don't worry, Steve, this is British Army, and because of the presence of this other man. And the, basically what he was saying was that the British Army in charge meant that we'd be away quickly and it'd be done, you know, professionally.
Yeah.
And what we didn't see was that there were 2 men planting 10 pounds of commercial explosive, which would have been lethal. This would have been like much, more lethal, say, than a 100-pound homemade fertilizer bomb or something like that. This was gelignite that would blow up.
Yeah, it's a huge amount.
Yeah, and he was putting it under the driver's seat. So, what the plan was that they would have said, "Thanks very much, off you go." We wouldn't have known about it. They reckon 10 to 15 minutes timer was on it. That would have blown up. We would have all died. Nobody would have known about the roadblock.
Yes.
And we would have been framed as terrorists. So they could have gone to the Irish government, demanded, seal the border, stop and search everybody, so curtail the movements of the IRA. That was the plan, and it was a good plan. But while the men were placing this, it went off. It exploded. And blew them to pieces. I mean, there was nothing left of them. Their arms and limbs were about 30 feet out or into the field, and very little left of them. Like the whole world, I was only standing a couple of feet from the thing when it went up, and the whole world seemed to turn red for me. And I went to run, and I couldn't run. I was actually in the air. I couldn't get any
traction.
And next minute, I felt that I was going down through the ditch into the field, and it felt like slow motion. I could almost, through my clothes, I could almost count every bush, every thorn, every, you know, it was that height, like a heightened sense of fear. Maybe it was adrenaline or something. I don't know. But
a bomb, a massive bomb, had just gone off beside you. It was massive.
And I was going down slowly, and then I hit the ground very hard, and it blew Desley off to the right, and then there was 2-3 other bodies fell on top of me. That was Tony, and Fran, and Brian. They immediately got up and got to their feet, but they tell me I had been shot while I was in the air. I'm not quite sure. I can never work out the logistics of that, but I was certainly shot by the time I hit the ground. And I had been shot by a thing called a dum-dum bullet. which was especially hollowed out. It explodes on impact.
Yeah.
And it entered my right hip and it traveled up through my body and exploded into 16 pieces. And then the rest of it went through my left lung and out under my left arm. So when I hit the ground, the lads got up and one of them, I think it was Brian McKay, tried to drag me out into the field away from what was happening. And here was a son of an Orange man, a Protestant lad from the north, dragging a Catholic from South Tipperary out into the field.
Yes.
And while he was doing that, the soldiers jumped down and they shot him, they murdered him, they shot him in the back and the head and the arms. So he died beside me and he couldn't pull me any farther. I must have been like a dead weight, so he probably... And the other two lads, Tony and Fran, tried to run, but they were caught by the soldiers very quickly. Hmm. And they were murdered straight away, and Fran got a particularly bad time. They shot him 22 times. And 7 of those were in the face. So you can imagine how badly injured he was, or how bad, you know, the trauma to the body was horrific. I heard them dying and calling and asking not to be killed.
And at that time you were, for all intents and purposes, you were lifeless.
But it was very much awake to the whole thing.
Yes, but from their appearance, you were already dead.
Well, they went around checking. One of the things that I remember very well is the cursing, the language that they were screaming, the obscenities the soldiers were shouting and calling, and the savagery of it was, and it was the obscenities that I remembered very. I couldn't believe that, you know.
Yeah, this is what
this, like, I couldn't figure out where was this hatred coming from, you know. I mean, we had been playing Clap Your Hands, Stomp Your Feet an hour beforehand, yeah, just up the road, and everything was cool, and
yeah,
and all of a sudden you hear people and they're doing this to us, you know. So I kept I lay down. I was lying down on the grass, and my cheek was on the grass, and I was thinking to myself, you know, will I get up? Or so I stayed where I was and pretended to be dead, and then methodically they walked around kicking the bodies and making sure that people were dead and actually firing into the dead bodies.
Mm.
And then he walked over to me, this soldier that was going around with this handgun. And at that stage, I considered, you know, kneel up or yeah, beg for my life or whatever. But I didn't. I stayed as quiet as I could, and I was convinced that he was going to fire into me. I was hoping that he'd either miss or he wouldn't, his aim wouldn't be right or whatever. And I was determined not to cry out. I said, you know, whatever happens here, I won't shout if he fires into me. And then somebody up on the road shouted, come on, I got those bastards with dum-dums, they're dead.
Mm.
It's the first time I ever heard the word dum-dum. And he turned around and he started to walk away, and every step he took, I was thinking, you know, is he going to fire? And it was a big relief. Every step that he took, I thought his aim won't be that good. You know?
Yes.
But he didn't. And he actually, he walked away, and and it was the added problem was that everything was on fire at that stage. All the ditch was on fire. The van was completely gone. And Des Lee had been blown into the ditch, and he watched all of that unfold. But he was now in danger of being burned alive, mm, because he was afraid to come out until they left.
Yes.
And they left. They eventually left, and he moved away from the fire, and he started calling our names, and he called Tony and Fran and Brian, and there was no answer, and then he called me, and I thought I answered perfectly clearly, but apparently I didn't. He said, are you okay? I said, I'm Grant. you don't realize what's
actually happening to you.
After happening.
And he will, oh, clearly not, because you were so, you even keyed in on the language of the men as opposed to your own body. You were external already. You were listening to what was being said rather than realizing you had been shot.
How long were you there, Steve?
Well, Des eventually climbed up onto the road, and any cars that it was a lorry came down, but the lorry had to try to maneuver. The road was on fire.
Yes.
And so it had to maneuver around whatever carnage was on the road. And the lorry driver wouldn't take him. He asked the lorry driver to take him into Newry, into the police station. The lorry driver thought maybe Des was involved in this thing. And he didn't, so he refused. He just drove on. Then a young couple came along, and they brought him in. But I was there for about 45 minutes to an hour, and the army were police were afraid to come in case the bodies were booby trapped, which would have been. So I was standing up and kneeling down. I couldn't figure out why I couldn't breathe properly.
Yes,
your lung was collapsed.
And so I went over to the tree at the side, and I was sort of trying to get relief, hanging off the, you know, trying to lean over the little branch and stuff like that. I couldn't figure out why this. I was lying down, and I remember we used to wear these ridiculous platform shoes at the time. There was all the, you know, and I remember clicking my feet together and thinking, I've got my feet. Yeah, I've got. Yeah. It's a bit like this Nina Simone song, but I checked my fingers. Yes. And they were there, and they were important. And then I almost like doing an NCT on yourself, you know. I sat up and I figured my back wasn't broken, and I couldn't find any blood. It was all internal. So my stomach was out like somebody 9 months pregnant.
Extended.
And then I would fall down and get up, and I eventually decided that the best way to get around the field to check on the other lads was to crawl on my belly. And I did, and I was telling them, well, Des was gone for, they were dead, but I wouldn't accept. And I was telling Des, I said, Des is gone for help. He'll be back and we'll all go home. That's what I said.
You were obviously in deep shock at the time. Deep shock at the time. What happened after that? Now, we know you recovered because you're sitting here with us. Mm. What happened with the investigation into this? What went on or did not go on afterwards? And how quickly did you find out what had been behind it?
Well, like so many people, I was in denial that I thought this was just, some bunch of thugs had stopped us and did this to us. And for 30 years, I would hear, you know, well, this was collusion, this was security forces, this was all of this. And I said, no, you know, that's impossible. That doesn't happen. I was brought up in a family that was, the police were good. There was bad guys, and there was the good guys were the police. And if you had a problem, you went to the guards or whatever it was, you know. So I just completely rejected any idea of collusion. I didn't hardly know the meaning of the word. But there was something that I should have maybe raised a red flag back at the time of the trials, because there was three men. There was two men initially were arrested, Thomas Raymond Crozier and Shane Roddick McDowell, and they were arrested for it, and we had to go to the preliminary trials first, which they held in Newry, and then trials in Belfast, which we were terrified to go to because we just thought, you know, we would give a statement, we're not going up there again. But,
yes.
But they agreed to fly us by helicopter from Besbrook. So, look, it was like a James Bond thing, you know, the whole thing was surreal, and we thought we just want to get it over with. And so they were convicted, and then I think it was the following year or something, John Somerville was also convicted for it, and they got the longest prison sentences ever handed down, 35 years each.
And it was an international story at the time. It was international story.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't have had the sort of, you know, the media access that you have today. Mm. This would have gone. But it was, remember all of the music, people often say it's the day the music died, but there was music basically in the north just stopped. All the visiting bands stopped. They yes. all stopped going in there, and it had a terrible effect. But it had the desired effect that these people wanted, because one of the great things about the show bands and the beat groups and the rock groups at the time was that they were bringing the communities together. And you know, we played to
anyone,
Catholics, Protestants, whether it didn't matter.
There anybody was no, who could there, dance was there.
There was no no-go areas. So we were, you know, perhaps. You know, the bands, the musicians were, if I may say so myself, you know, one of the really, really good forces, or, you know, forces for good, basically, talk about reconciliation. They were bringing people together so there'd be an outrage, and still sectarianism was left outside the door.
Yes.
You know, people, a young Catholic boy would see a young Protestant girl or vice versa, and nature took its course, and that's what, you know. So we were healing. We were a healing constituent in the north.
30 years passed, and what made you change your view on what happened?
Well, what happened was our daughter was born 16 years after that event, and when she got to. When she got to school age, we were living in London, because basically I thought that, you know, I just wanted my life back again. Now we reformed the band, and I thought that that'll work. And instantly I realized I don't want to be in this, because we were now famous for something that I had nothing to do with, you know. It wasn't people were coming to look at us rather than
a spectacle.
And it was massive. I mean, the band was huge again, even if anything, bigger than ever. But within 6 weeks of going back on the road, we went back. It must have been the end of September or October, and I shouldn't have gone back. I wasn't well, ready. But I was very keen. I thought I'd get my life back together. And people didn't know. It was unprecedented. People didn't know, you know, whether they should ask for her autograph, shake hands with her, or genuflect. Yeah. It was just one of those things.
Offer condolences.
That's an unnatural thing for, you know, people go out to
a joyous event.
And yeah. Yeah.
So I gave my notice, and I said, I just don't want to be part of this. And they convinced me to stay until the summertime. And I went back down to South Tipperary, and I thought, well, I'll play with the local lads. But it was, you know, it was always reminds me of that. My favorite song by the Eagles is called New Kid in Town.
Yeah.
And it was like, I was like a new kid in my own hometown, you know. Yes. It was like people saw me as something different. So we eventually, like Anne and I, we went to the UK.
Yeah.
Where, to London, where nobody knew. Who we were,
and I was, and you could be anonymous again.
Yeah. And I, but then I founded the Irish World newspaper in the UK, and people began to focus in
on
who was, so, you know, it was uncomfortable. So about 20 years ago, we came back when our daughter got to school age. We came back, but there was, at that time, I think there was the Barron Tribunal had started up. Judge Barron was looking into collusion.
Yes.
And so I thought, well, look, I'll do my bit. I had been asked, you know, would you like to give evidence at the Barron Tribunal? And I said, well, I'll do my bit, but what I have to offer is insignificant. But you see, as I say, during the preliminary trials, what should have flagged something up to me was that when I mentioned to our legal team at the time, I said, you know, well, will I tell them about this British soldier and the different uniform and all that? And they actually said, no, it's not important.
Okay.
Which, you know, today would be like an outrageous thing.
Yes.
But anyway, I put that out of my head. And then all those years later, we came back and I was given evidence with Judge Byrne in the Department of the Taoiseach here in Dublin. And I began to think, you know, this wasn't a bunch of thugs. This was just so well done that it needed amazing planning and coordination. And I began to look into it. And 2007, Neil and I wrote the book. And that made us look into it even further. And then the HET, which was the historical inquiries team set up by the British government, came over and to look into collusion. And the evidence is overwhelming that there was collusion, that there was... So, you know, I'm in absolutely no doubt whatsoever. We've taken a case against the chief constable of the PSNI and also against civil action against the British Ministry of Defence for their part in the murder of the three lads and my attempted murder.
And now, where we're at right now, can you tell us where you're at right now with this? Because this is this, and I don't mean this in a positive way, this is an exciting time for you that you're in right now. This story is going to go global once again.
Yeah.
And you're on the precipice of that right now.
Well, something strange happened about, it must have been about 6 years ago. I'm not great with dates, but some friends of mine, a man called Michael Gallagher, whose son was murdered in OMA, the IRA, you know, that are the INLA, I don't know which of them did, I think it's the OMA bomb, which is indiscriminate murder there. And Michael's son, Aidan, was murdered in that. And Michael broke ground for all of the victims because it was in Europe. Europe didn't want to know about the Irish problem. You know, it had a very cold attitude to Ireland. And Michael became involved in basically an advocate for the OMA people. They called it the OMA support group. And he started to speak at conventions and around Europe as part of radicalization awareness network, and people became aware. And Michael, you know, it's hard to underestimate, you know, what he did.
Yeah, he managed to put his personal tragedy, and actually, as you used the word very strongly there, I talked about radicalization.
Yeah.
And that's very important in the context of where we stand as a country, as a people. We often hear that thrown around in the context of, you know, oh, they were radicalized in terms of what happens in the Middle East. We don't tend to look at it as much as you know, we talk in sectarian terms in our own recent past and today. And that is actually, when you put it in today's political context, how dangerous that is with Brexit. It's the first time we've used the word, but that's the truth. That represents a threat to peace and stability on this island.
Well, Michael, as I say, was the one that made we all think, obviously, that everybody knows his story, but he brought the story of OMA, and he became very highly respected and regarded as somebody who went out and told the story from the victim's point of view. He would have been dealing with the Spanish, French, all of the people, Algerians, all of those people who had gone through a conflict. But Ireland is the most experienced, in recent history. So they obviously valued Michael's testimony and how he dealt with it, and that's what they wanted. And they returned the compliment because he had spoken in all of the major cities, and they RAN. Radicalization Awareness Network, I think it was, they decided to hold their one of their big events in the north, and it was in the Ulster Folk Park where they held it. And Michael called me, and I'd been one of the lads in the band that, never mind not singing, I hardly ever, I hardly ever introduce a song, spoken. So Michael said to me, will you be our guest speaker? Because I had gone up to the opening of their new premises in Market Street a couple of months before. And he said, will you be our guest speaker? He said, we have two speakers for the international convention. And I said, well, I don't know if I'd give it a go, but I said, who's the other speaker? And they said, well, it's Terry Waite, the man who had been disappeared in Beirut for a long time. Yes. And I thought, well, this is a giant, I don't think so, Michael. I'm not going to, but it worked out well. And I was invited to speak all over Europe at universities and conventions, and I got a lot of confidence. I felt I'm actually turning my experience into something good.
Positive, yes.
And I got overconfident. And one day you begin to think that you're a bit of a star turn, this is like everybody wants me to go out and do this, I must be good at it. And one day I was giving a talk and it was in Amsterdam or The Hague. It was to a convention of psychologists, where they're, you're almost like in a fishbowl, people are
They weren't listening to you, they were studying you.
But, I felt, I was kind of holding my own. And and there was this lady there called Jo Dover, and she was one of the facilitators at Warrington, where those two little lads were murdered, Jonathan Ball and Tim Parry, two children. The IRA murdered them. And she said, look, would you come over and be part of our, would you take part in what she called a residential? So she said, it's not like, what you're doing here in The Hague or in Amsterdam or in Badajoz or any of those places. She said, you don't stand up on a podium, you don't talk and tell your story. What you do with us is we bring 12 people and we put 6 in one room, 6 in another room, sit around, have coffee and chat about. And these are all people who would have experienced some kind of trauma or life-changing event. And he said, I think you'd be good for the people that we're bringing over because you can explain to them how you got through your trauma. And I was convinced that I had got through it, because I had seen a psychiatrist in 1976 to be assessed. We had a small claim for actually instruments and things like that. And the psychiatrist had said to me, I think you're handling this too well. I think it's, I don't like the idea that you're
high functioning now.
And, I would say to him, I had to see him every month for the best part of a year. And I thought he was the one that needed help. But he would say this, I'm uneasy about this. And I would say to him every time, look, I went to a gig. On the way home, the lads got murdered. I got shot and I got well. End of story. I'm fine. There's no problem. And he said, well, that is unusual. This shouldn't be the case. You should be.
Yes.
You shouldn't be as
you know. You were a young man and, there's an element.
That's what I said.
A young man and there's an element of braggadocio I'm bulletproof. You can't,
There was that.
Is an element of that.
And that's what I'd say to him. And he said, well, I'm thinking of giving you sodium pentothal, which is the truth serum, where they inject you with James Bond stuff tell the truth. And you, in a controlled environment, you actually let it all out and then you unburden yourself. Mm. And then he said, well, okay, I don't... okay, well, let's not go down that route. Maybe you're one in a million or 10 million that handles this. Maybe you're that strong. And I thought, of course I am.
Yeah. And, me.
Yeah. And he said, but I have to tell you, he said, that in 6 months' time, 12 months' time, a year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years, he said, and I always remember the term he used, he said, the wall might fall on you.
Mm.
He said, the wall will fall on you.
And that's the wall you have built.
I was over in Warrington, and I'm sitting there with these six people in this room, and Joe Dover said, I want you to bring something with you that reminds you or it connects you to the incident that changed your life, you know, that, a talisman of some sort. I have an office at home, and the last minute, you know, I was just about to catch a plane from Cork over to John Lennon Airport because that's the closest to Warrington. And I thought, God, what, I better bring something with me. And Tony Gertie, our guitar player, and he was the closest to me in the band. He had left, he had been in my house down in Carrickinshire, although we had moved to Dublin to live, but we'd been playing down around that area. So we went back to our house in Carrickinshire and brought in some of all my friends. We had a jam session. And Tony had changed his strings. And when you take the strings off, you take the old one, you put it into the pouch that the new one came from. And he left some strings. So there was a string in my office that Tony had used. And I thought, well, that's handy. You know, I'll stick that in my pocket and bring that as my talisman. So we're sitting around in Warrington, and we're everybody's pretty chilled out and talking about, and there's... And she started the ball rolling, and there was this man got up to talk, and he was I couldn't describe him anything other than a total wreck. This man, he said he had been a British soldier, he had served in Aden, seen some terrible things, he had been abused as a child, he had been abusing alcohol and drugs, and his life was a wreck. He was like, this man was like in a bad way. And the more he spoke, the more I was sitting down thinking to myself, I'm really looking forward to, as Joe said, helping these people to get through there and to tell them how I managed to get through it, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, oh, I can't wait to, and I'll say something profound.
Yeah.
That was the kind of almost like an arrogance that I had. I'll say something profound.
But I think it was telling that you chose a string. I think that was very telling.
Well, this man had brought along a little fire engine, a toy fire engine, and you put the talisman on the table in front of you, and you focus, and you tell the people listening, you say, he said all I ever wanted to be in my life was a fireman, and he went through all his experience in the army and all of the different things. And he said that he eventually became a fireman, and it didn't work out. So it was like that to him was the end of the world, you know, because he had blamed that he had taken all the wrong choices, made all the wrong choices. And then when he actually got to be a fireman, it didn't work because he had been so traumatized. And so they went around, and everybody spoke, and there was some very harrowing stories. So Joe said to me, she said, well, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us what you brought along and why? And I stood up very confidently, and I said, my name is Stephen Travers, and I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor, and I always said I'm a survivor. I would never admit to being a victim, you see. I said I'm a survivor of the Miami Chopin incident. And I brought along, and I went to put my hand into my pocket of my jacket to take out Tony's guitar string, and the wall fell on me. I will never, ever forget that. I cried for the first time, sobbing, for the first time in 35 years. It was the worst. I just didn't want to be there. And all of a sudden, these poor people that I had been pitying 2 minutes ago, this poor man, this soldier, is up there with his arm around me, and he's comforting me, and I could hear the voices, and I could hear them saying, you know, it's okay, it happens to everyone, but no words would come out of my mouth. And I was saying, I was trying to say, it doesn't happen to me, you know, I'm one in a million, I'm one in 10 million, I'm a survivor. That was the first time that I ever realized I was a victim, and I admitted it. And that had a terrible effect on me. It took me about two years to get over that.
I don't know, Stephen.
It took you a very long time to get to that point, Stephen. It took a very, very long time. after that, what became it? You changed your goals, your what you wanted to do. You then became an advocate for reconciliation. After that,
that was the first time I really had to. You're right. It was the first time I had to face up to what trauma does to you. Mm. This is the first time that I had to say, you know, acknowledge what happened to me, rather than, because up until then I was able to stand outside myself, look at a different person, and listen to myself talk, and you know, and it was a bit like playing the bass. It was no problem to me.
Yes,
It gave me, although it was a terrible experience, it gave me an empathy with other victims for the first time. I always saw those as unfortunate poor victims.
Yeah, not of me or not.
No, I'm not one of them. That's what I thought.
The expression is, what labels me diminishes me. Is that the expression? So sometimes when you're seen, if you see yourself as a victim, you may diminish, you see yourself as less than, but we have to understand that that's not actually true. We are our experiences. We are actually our traumas as well. And I think it's a real credit, whether it was 3 months or 30 years that it took you to go on to reconcile yourself to that. But I think it's a credit that you're able to even speak so clearly and so eloquently to us about it. So, you know, we all deal with things in different ways. And I just, you know.
So the reconciliation then for you, and that's, it's very clear from you here that reconciliation you see across the board, that this isn't a sectarian thing. There is no, this is about healing everybody's trauma, and that everybody should be involved in this.
The only thing, the only really effective cure, if you can call it a cure, but for the problems that we have on the island of Ireland, because there's so much hate, you know, if people can tell you, you know, well, we've got peace, and we haven't. We've got a cessation of violence. All of the old hatreds, all of the old suspicions and mistrusting each other, that's all still there.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't been addressed. So the only thing is, and I've always believed this, is education. You've got to educate ourselves. We've got to educate, and I'm no longer the arrogant person that stood up at the University of Extremadura in Spain, in Badajoz, and spoke to people as if I was, you know, somebody like that can explain how to get through something. But as I say, the upshot to it, the good side to it was the fact that I knew what a victim was.
Yes.
So, and I said, I really don't want this to happen to anyone else, because it is just too terrible. But it all came from that visit to Warrington.
Yeah.
I never realized it, because when those people were trying to comfort me, I was not in Warrington. I was stepping out of the van. That was it. I could not get out of that.
Mm.
And unfortunately, I mean, you know, that didn't cure me. I'm still trying to get out of that field, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm a great believer I always have been fascinated by the Philosopher's Stone, by, you know, turning base metal into gold. So I've been
you heard the entomology of that and all the stories of that throughout the ages. Yeah, it's a fascinating tale, all right.
Yeah, it's you know, if we can do that, then we can actually defeat what it is that tried to defeat us. You know, so to take that experience and to say, the only way to beat that experience is to say, I'm going to switch that around, turn it on its head. And it does give you a degree of, I suppose, satisfaction is one way of putting it, you know. But also, one of the terrible things that becoming a victim of, especially in terrorism, or could be of rape, or could be of, you know, racial abuse, whatever it is that you feel helpless, and your sense of worth is not just diminished. Sometimes it's in my case, it was taken away. I was at the very, very top of the of my game in Ireland. You know, I couldn't have gone any further unless I went to the UK and joined the Beatles or something.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Which I believed I was going to do when I was 14. You know, but and I had that kind of confidence. So, you know, I was at the top of it, and all of a sudden, within an hour, I'm on the flat of my back. I'm whispering into the ears of people that like hardly existed anymore, crawling around on my stomach. I mean, how low can you go? Mm-hmm. And there's, I was talking to an old friend of mine the other day. Actually, I'm reading his book at the moment, Tommy Sands, the great folk singer in the North. And Tommy says something. He was talking about a great song that he wrote called "There Were Roses." It's a fabulous song. And I mean, he's been all around the world with it. And he said, Irish people sing sad songs, he said, not to bring sadness, he said, but to bring it out of us. Mm. Yes. You know, I thought it was just a wonderful thing. So I believe that, you know, that we must lance this boil. We must put our hand in and take out the toxicity. And we see the effect of Truth and Reconciliation Platform, our organization. We call it TARP, Truth and Reconciliation Platform. And what it is that we give people a voice that never had voices, and we allow them to, you know, on a balanced thing, Catholics, Protestants, people from all walks, and they get on the platform and they say, you know, I'm not here to lecture you. I'm not here to tell you should or you shouldn't use violence as a political expedient or as an instrument for social change. But what I'm telling you is, if you do choose violence, your story can become mine, and this is my story. And somebody like Kathleen Gillespie or Eugene Reevey or Alan McBride or any of those people, and they're all powerful, powerful stories. Yes. But there are so many stories that
there are thousands.
Thousands. I believe if you were to take a poll, if you stand at the top of, it might be an interesting exercise for anyone, stand at the top of Grafton Street, take a poll, the first 1,000 people, and ask these people to name one single person who was killed in the Dublin bombings.
Yes.
I guarantee you 95% of these will not be able to name one person.
Now, that brings us on to where you're at now. The story of the Miami, as it was at that stage, is now going to be on Netflix.
Yeah.
And it's going to be opened up to the whole world again.
It is.
And how do you feel about that?
Well, you know, it's a very difficult thing to tell the stories, but I believe it's an important thing, because the education, if we don't learn from the past, we don't know. But I think the stories that happened in Ireland, the story of the Miami is as relevant here in Dublin, in Belfast. It's also relevant in Kandahar or Baghdad or any of these places where you have Somalia, any of these places where you've got conflict. And how it's not a case anymore of this is how I got through it. It's also a case of this is how I didn't get through it. And this is,
and this is how I live with it.
This is how I live with it. This is how I deal with it. And if you can learn something from my story, one of my great friends was a giant in Irish politics, is Seamus Mallon. And Seamus said, chaired some of our events. His autobiography is coming out very soon now. He's just finished it. But he said, violence didn't change Irish history. It interrupted Irish history. He said, there's nothing that we have today that we couldn't have achieved without killing people. And I firmly believe that. And there are people today, and now I have, as you'll see on the Netflix film, I've engaged with people that might surprise, but I believe that, you know, we must set an example. And a huge part of the work we do in TARP, apart from standing up and telling the stories and trying to give a balance, because our mantra was, you know, no side has a monopoly on suffering or loss. And you'll understand that if you listen to, you know, to both sides, people talking. I've never seen a green tear or an orange tear. You know, loss is loss.
Yes.
And you might say, well, there was something really wrong in the first place. And there was. terrible wrong there in the first place to make it all happen. There was terrible injustice and all that. But the day that the first innocent person was killed, just to no side then anymore had any moral high ground. And these are the lessons we must take away from this. So it gives me, it's a bit selfish, I suppose. It gives me a sense of worth. It gives me something that I've actually managed to turn this into something good. And Netflix gives us the biggest platform. You're looking at about 520 million people. Yes. They've got 130 million subscribers, and each subscription is four. You multiply by four, because it could be four people in the family or whatever. It's like newspapers.
I have no doubt this is going to be one of the biggest Netflix events that we've seen in recent years. And from
especially in an Irish context, it's going to be.
And from my point of view, you're that rare example of a person who leads by example. And you are leading by example, and that's rare in the world these days. And I know we could talk about this for a lot more, but I think we've come to the end of this. And I think your story is both terrifying, fascinating, and there's a positive at the end of it. There's a very great positive at the end of it. And I can only thank you for coming in and talking to us. Very much thank you for coming in and talking to us.
That was my privilege to talk to your listeners.
Stephen, I'm absolutely thrilled to have had this conversation. I hope the listeners get as much out of it as we have. I have had chills in my spine several times while you were talking. And in relation to the work of TARP and that, we will happily tweet that stuff out and add it to the podcast links, and we will let people know that if they're affected by any of this, where they can reach out and get in touch with you guys. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Stephen. A very great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.